Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to our show on restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Pretty good.
I would like to discuss with our listeners the Manhattan Cocktail Classic, which we just experienced here in New York City.
Which we got to call somebody and say, Mother's Day weekend?
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, crushing.
We presented at the Manhattan Cocktail Classic seminars for the first two years mm-hmm. of its existence.
And on the Sunday. And that's normally when we presented was on the Sunday.
And it's Mother's Day weekend.
It's Mother's Day day.
It's Mother's Day itself,
It was Mother's Day day. And this year we had the hailstorm. And for those of you who don't know, you know, Rutgers is in New Brunswick.
And that's where our restaurants are.
So Rutgers graduated on Mother's Day.
Yeah, it was nuts.
40,000 students graduating, Mother's Day mayhem.
That was an unfortunate move by Rutgers that probably took $750,000 out of the Middlesex County economy.
Oh, it took a lot, that's for sure. Certainly,
you would have, you know, all the restaurants in the county would be busy, or in this part of the county anyway, would be busy on Mother's Day, and mm-hmm. then again a week or two later on graduation day. But, you know, if your restaurant's 95% busy, okay, I had 105% worth of business, but then I lost another crazy busy Sunday.
And I'm going to take this down to a more personal level because that's kind of my job.
I'm the mean one. I revel in being the mean one.
But you also took a day that's supposed to be all about mom, and you made it all about the kid again.
Yeah, unless mom was graduating. In which case,
mom was graduating.
Still combined her
right.
days. You know what I mean?
You still took one of her days away, exactly.
I didn't get all that.
But so, you got to spend some time at the Manhattan Cocktail Classic while I was reveling in the revelers.
Well, while you were minding the store, you mean? While you kept our business afloat? Actually, I caught the last hour... Just the last hour of the Manhattan Cocktail Classic Gala, which is the, that's the coolest consumer cocktail party in the country every year, bar none.
What a magnificent event it is! I mean, just every great cocktailian is in the place.
Every great cocktailian is in the place. All the cocktail enthusiasts are in the place. The music they had this year was better than ever. They rent the entire New York Public Library, right? 3,000 of your closest friends. It's black tie or fancy or commensurately fancy. You may wear a fedora if you have a head.
I have to say, my favorite thing about the change to this year's.
What's that?
Is an app to see where your favorite bartenders
are.
How cool was that?
There was a Manhattan Cocktail Classic app that you download on your phone to keep track of all the events that are going on all around the city and where you are and who's pouring what in relation to you. That was very cool and surprising. I didn't know that was coming. So, and the music was fantastic this year. They had Vince Giordano and the Nighthawks, Vince Giordano and the Nighthawks are a classic big band. They play in New York once in a while, and they're also on Boardwalk Empire. They do a lot of the soundtrack for Boardwalk Empire.
Right, absolutely.
And Ted Hay is the dramaturg for the slavishly literal and correct scenery and all the stuff that goes on, and especially the drinking culture and the music. It's just phenomenal. And the whole thing was phenomenal in the New York Public Library, and they set up, you know, drink stations all over. I was only there for an hour. I went to the Campari area. I had some fantastic drinks there. And Campari had a bunch of cool stuff going on there that was terrific, parties, and it was just great. But one of the more interesting things that we have, in addition to all the seminars we went to, is on the last day, there is basically a spirits tasting. I mean, hundreds of spirits that may not be distributed in New York, New Jersey.
It's not really a spirits tasting. It's different than your average spirits tasting.
It's an
independent.
Artisanal, the independent stuff. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. I found some really cool stuff. And so, with your permission, I want to talk about a few things, but with your permission, Mark, I grabbed a couple of bottles of things that were poured there that aren't yet available here. I think they're just becoming available here. Really unusual things, and I want to see if we can do a blind tasting.
You have my permission.
All right, hold on a second. So talk to the people while I make a drink.
All right, so Francis is literally getting up now and getting ready to make a drink. He's got things in – he's got clear liquids in clear bottles, so I can't tell what they are. So I know that was a clear liquid.
Yeah.
Francis is stirring, by the way, in case you're wondering. Francis is stirring, and the bartender kind, not the discontented kind. So Francis really is gonna has brought me back some stuff that he wants me to taste blind, and that always scares me a little bit because whenever you taste something blind, you always have the opportunity to look really, really stupid.
Well, I don't know how you're gonna react to this because I didn't get the opportunity to taste it blind, but I thought it was fetching. We'll see if you agree.
Fetching.
I was like, what is
Can
that?
Can I tell you something?
Yeah, I'm
there's
gay.
Really
you
nothing,
think I'm gay?
There's really nothing that I drink that I consider fetching, ever.
Well, you haven't had this
ever.
Yet, now
not
have you?
Not YooHoo, nor
you haven't had
Gatorade,
this yet,
nor the finest red wine in all the land.
Okay, now this is the less interesting one to me because it's a vodka, and I think vodkas are great, but some of them are less interesting. As a category, I find it a little less interesting.
So what's really cool about having the show on a podcast and not broadcast terrestrially right here is Francis and I...
Terrestrially, and he hasn't even had a drink yet.
Man, not saying that again. Francis and I can drink while we're on the show.
You're not allowed to have liquor
not
in a commercial radio station.
In a radio station.
Yeah, FCC.
That's so you don't get drunk.
Oh, yeah.
And say stupid stuff. Well, Francis, I don't mind if we get drunk
and
say stupid stuff.
Hold you don't mind either, our listeners. Can you tell...
Okay, go ahead.
Can you tell... Or do you have an idea what the base spirit of that, what the base of that vodka might be?
What it's from?
Yeah, what is distilled to make that vodka?
Hmm. Well, one thing I will tell you is the vodka's dense. I get a lot of viscosity from it. But the base of that vodka, I have no idea. I'm going to say... Can I guess?
Make one guess, and do me a favor, try it warm first, because it's actually...
Francis has made me a martini, so I'm going to go back to trying it at room temperature. I don't know. It's got a little kind of caraway-ness to it. A
little bit of a caraway-ness to it, yeah. Is there a... Do you find the nose kind of different at all?
Very.
And on the palate, I find it... Well, what do you find on the palate?
Like I said, it's fairly viscous for a vodka.
And even in its...
I don't know. Help me out here.
In its warm state, I find it fairly viscous as well. I'm going to pour you a gin made from the same base material.
So they made a vodka and then they made a gin from the vodka.
Yeah,
oh, that's
yeah.
very interesting.
So, hold on.
But Francis always has to taste first, in case you're wondering.
I want to make sure... That's delicious. I want to make sure it's right. In there, I think you can really see that that's a different gin.
It smells great.
Doesn't it?
Junipery. And
yeah. But there's something else there, and you're not going to be able to get what it is. But it's rounder and sweeter. It's unbelievable.
It's plums.
No.
You said round and sweet.
Here, try. I was talking about you. Sorry. The gin is what I'm really in love with. And that's... Isn't that crazy?
Boy, the gin's great.
Doesn't it almost taste like it's already made into a martini or something? It's just straight gin.
Great.
Isn't that fantastic?
The gin is great.
Bar Hill Gin, Vermont spirit. From
syrup.
Nope, from Caledonia Spirits.
Good.
It's made from honey.
Oh, that's cool.
They're both made from raw honey.
That's
and this
cool.
has juniper, and they have juniper in the gin.
I think it's fantastic, isn't it?
The
gin is magnificent. The vodka didn't make me say wow, but the gin is magnificent.
Because you can almost get the honey there, but it's almost ethereal. Like you don't know what it is.
That's really good.
That's me pausing to sip, by the way. It's a little early in the day, but it's already made. I don't want it to go to waste. Yeah, okay, so this is Caledonia Spirits. You can find them at caledoniaspirits.com. We're going to put this all up on the website under Restaurant Guys Radio. And they make a mead. And I mean, the stuff, and I tried them, it's really super high quality, crazy stuff. Mead is, of course, a wine made from honey.
Mm-hmm.
And they ferment it dry, they age it for a year in stainless steel tanks, and then they add a little bit of honey in the end, so it's a sweet wine.
You know, as you say that, I get a little bit of mead in here.
Yeah.
I get a little bit of mead, more than just the honey, I taste mead.
It's distilled of mead. And with the gin, I think... The juniper goes so well with that honey. It's amazing.
And definitely it is very, very fragrant gin.
Yeah.
It's really, but not, you know, sometimes that almost gets a bitter note to it.
Yep.
when the juniper's all fired
yeah.
up in there.
Yeah.
And this doesn't have that at all.
It's so clean. It's freaking great.
I'm really cool.
I don't even know if it's available in New Jersey, but if you can get it, I would check it out. And we're going to lean on them. I got something else for you here. Let's go. I'm going to go through the odd spirits I came across at the Manhattan Cocktail Classic
all right,
Spirits
I'm in.
Expo. You ready?
I'm in.
Vermont White Vodka. From Keechee George Village.
Okay, hold on.
Keechee, Vermont.
Isn't it all white?
Yeah, it is. But
really clear.
This is, they have Vermont Gold Vodka, which is I guess their reserve. It's called the Keechee Gorge Village. VermontSpirits.com. If you go to VermontSpirits.com, you can find Vermont Spirits Distilling Company, another Vermont product made into a vodka. That was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Milk. Yeah, fermented milk. They ferment the milk and then make vodka from it.
Really, from the sugar and
from the fermented milk. Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how they do it from there, but I mean, you have
that's creeping me out a little. I'm not gonna,
it won't, but I would not have brought it to you if you didn't really dig it. Orleans cocktail. There's Orleans. You can find it. There's a cider mill.
Mm-hmm.
Apples,
and
also from Vermont.
Also in Vermont.
EdenCider.com. That's EEDEN. IceCider.com. ICECIDER. EdenIceCider.com. They make an aperitif from apple cider. It's kind of like a quinquina kind of a thing. A little poured over ice, and it's.
It's got a bitter.
A little bit of bitterness to it.
Okay.
Yeah, pretty cool stuff. All right, that was another one that I found up there. We
yep.
carry the Koval Spirits. Koval, organic and kosher, made in Chicago. They make a line of white spirits. And what's really interesting that we have behind our bar is we have a millet spirit, we have a wheat spirit, we have a barley spirit, and we have a rye spirit. And
it's very interesting to taste them side by side
You
know, the same kind of the same process with the different grains, how different they become.
Sure, and you get to, I mean, if you're interested in learning about spirits, first of all, they're tasty. I mean, they're white dogs, right? So that means they're not aged in wood at all, so they don't pick up any color. But if you want to identify, you know, we always hear, rye is made of primarily rye, but there's some corn in the mash, and bourbon is made of primarily corn, but there's some rye in the mash.
I'm sorry, what are they called again?
White dogs.
The only time I'd ever heard that phrase used was to refer to you.
And that was just dog.
So taking another sip, by the way, Francis.
I'm
wondering what Francis is doing. If you get a little pause there where there's no one talking, that's Francis sipping on his martini.
I was just about to say, the show would go much slower if we had martinis during the show every time, just to allow for sipping time. Anyway, so these guys at Koval, I think that's a really cool thing to have behind your bar to help teach your guests
or to have
a little parlor trick when people come over. Plus, they're nice and tasty. They had some brown spirits now. And
I've never seen any of the brown spirits.
I hadn't either. But my favorite and the most interesting, they had a rye corn rye mash and they had a corn rye bourbon mash. Just like everybody else in the world. Mm-hmm. And it was very good. But they had a dark millet whiskey. It was like brown in color, and it was made of 100% millet. And it was really fantastic.
And do you know why it was so brown?
Koval Spirits. Heavy roast on it and on the barrel and also on the millet.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if that's true or not. I totally made that up. It's probably not true. Just wanted to see if I just had a half a martini, so I'm messing with you a little bit. Also had another really great eau de vie producer, Warwick Valley Winery. Where are they from? They're from New York State? They're from New York State.
And they're making eau de vie from their wines.
Warwick, New York. Yeah, they're making eau de vie, they're making cider, and they're making – so that they're I thought their black currant cordial was terrific. We're going to try and get that in for spirits. And their pear eau de vie, they're basically their pear Williams, although it wasn't a Williams pear. Also delicious, really interesting.
So why do they call pear William?
It's the type of pear. It's the type of pear that goes into it. It's named a Williams pear.
I really thought you were going to tell me a better story than that.
That's
the part I knew. I was really looking for something better than that.
I was like, you knew that. I wish I'd had something made up to come along. Okay. St. George Spirits. Currently not available in Jersey.
St. George Spirits, we carried some of these before. They were really great.
We want to get them back into New Jersey.
Absolutely.
The guy at St. George Spirits is doing fantastic work. He's a really talented distiller, and he has three gins. He has Button of War gin, which is sort of his basic gin. He has a Terroir gin, which is, he's in San Francisco, and it's a gin that has botanicals that you find
in and around
San Francisco. And so he has like sage in there and stuff. It's really cool. And just a completely different spirit than his regular gin. And then he has a dry rye gin. So in other words, the base material that they distilled to make the gin is from rye. It's 100% rye, 100% pot-stilled rye in the gin. All fantastic. He's also got an absinthe, an American absinthe, and a lot of American absinthe I haven't really liked. I thought it was too hot and too angular. His absinthe is terrific, really, really terrific. Just a couple of shout-outs. I know we're going to run out of time soon, but Redemption Rye, the Redemption Company, we've done some work with them
very
here in
good.
New Jersey.
Very good.
They
had
they showed a rye, a high rye bourbon, and a bourbon. two ryes, a high rye whiskey and a bourbon, all really good spirits. The high rye bourbon was crazy good, and the Redemption Rye is terrific. We carry those in our bar. Tuttletown Spirits, we've carried them in the past.
Yeah, Tuttletown, I'm familiar with them.
You know what? They're one of the first new New York distilleries, and I think one of the reasons I wanted to take the time to talk about this on the show was I want to give props to the Manhattan Cocktail Classic. I also want to give props to these small distillers, and also New York and New Jersey have in recent years, and New Jersey more recently than New York, changed their distilling laws to allow for micro distilleries. Mm-hmm. And
it has made a tremendous difference.
My goodness.
You know, Francis and I have been carrying a bunch of these new little, you know, micro distiller products, and they're cool, and they're different, and they're their own thing. And that's one of the things I really like about them. And some of them are more interesting than others, but you know, having that chance to see all those different expressions is fun for us, too.
And what was great about being in the Manhattan Cocktail Classic is we've known a bunch of guys who do this, but these are the new, and no disrespect to any of the folks who we currently are dealing with, but these are a lot of new folks for us. The owners were there. You know, you've created businesses in the States that allow this. And, you know, this isn't selling cheap rot gut to teenagers who get drunk on it. These are fairly expensive spirits.
Sure.
I would venture to say that almost none of this is drunk underage. You know what I mean? And frankly, I wouldn't think much of it would be drunk by people who are alcoholics drinking as much as they can. You know, I think these are really artisanal products that speak well of the region, that use the agriculture of the region and create jobs there. The Hudson whiskeys are fairly expensive, I must say, but they're quite good.
You might have seen these. These have been out for a little bit.
The brown spirits only come in little 375 milliliter bottles, so they look like moonshine a little bit, which is really cool. And that's all I got. That's my big thing. But I would say that my most exciting find for the Manhattan Cocktail Classic 2012 is Caledonia Spirits Bar Hill Gin from Honey. I mean,
yeah, that was really
and,
cool.
And it's their own bees. I mean, it's all New York State honey, their own bees. Isn't that crazy?
You mean Vermont?
Vermont.
I'm
that's
here
what
to
I
say
mean.
Vermont for you.
It's all north.
That's my job. It's north of us.
It's all north
cold,
of us.
Someplace cold.
Almost Canada. That's Canada light. So we're going to post all of those up on this show on our website so you can check out all those brands. And if you can go to the Manhattan Cocktail Classic next year, by all means, go.
Yeah, it is a great, great program.
If you want to write them a letter telling them not to do it on Mother's Day, that'd be really terrific. Hey, listen, stick with us. We're going to learn how to make pizza at home. No kidding, really, not the crappy pizza at home in the toaster oven. We're going to make real pizza at home with one of the, I don't know, most important guys having to do with dough in America, Jim Leahy. He owns Sullivan Street Bakery. He invented the no-knead method of making bread that's taken over the world. He's got a restaurant called Company in Manhattan. And his new book is My Pizza, the easy, no-knead way to make spectacular pizza at home. And we'll be talking with him in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, The Restaurant Guys, and our guest today is Jim Leahy. Jim owns Sullivan Street Bakery in New York City, one of our favorite bakeries, one of the best bakeries in New York City, and that makes it one of the best bakeries in the country. He also owns Company Restaurant. His method of no-knead dough for bread revolutionized bread baking around the world. And his new book is called My Pizza, the easy, no-knead way to make spectacular pizza at home.
Hey, Jim, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Mark. Thank you, Francis.
Your bread place is pretty cool. You opened in 94 on Sullivan Street?
Yes. I opened in 94, and it was a very, let's say, formative experience for me.
Well, your bread instantly became a hit around New York. You were kind of the bread king of Lower Manhattan, and
were.
I'm sorry.
Thanks, man.
You
but it's true. I mean, everybody.
What is it called when you become something but you're still it? What is that tense? I don't know what that is.
I don't know.
But you.
I'm just a man who makes bread.
Well, listen, man.
I cook things.
Your bread immediately became the darling of downtown. And your bread not only was just about in your store, but you began to supply a lot of really cool restaurants, which you still do. And you've moved to bigger digs where you supply a lot of folks. Now, let's talk about some innovations that you came up with. I think, obviously, the bread shot heard around the world was when Mark Bittman covered your no-knead method of making bread dough. That was a really important moment for you, wasn't it?
Yes, that was, without realizing it, and certainly if I knew now what I knew then, and I was maybe more of a normal American capitalist kind of guy, I would have capitalized on all that. I just was kind of like tsunamied and overwhelmed by the response and kind of, kind of shocked, if you will.
It changed the way people make bread professionally as well as at home. I mean, it was really revolutionary. You want to tell our listeners a little bit about how?
Go back to this notion of practice.
Yeah.
And go back to this notion of standard. And if I'm going to change or affect change in a culture, and I would love in my lifetime to know that I've changed the way we look at bread, the way we eat bread, the way that bread is made, and also the standards that exist for bread.
Mm-hmm.
The only way we can make that happen is not like it's not the trickle down theory, but it's the trickle up theory. It's got to start in the home.
Uh-huh.
It's got to. We have to unlock and unleash and help people get over their inhibitions or fears or whatever issues they have with like dough or wet gooey sticky things as it relates to food, and make it almost kind of idiotically simple or seemingly idiotically, how did that happen? The objective of the no-knead method and trying to get it out there was to give everyone, as many people as I could, the same aha moment, the same experience, the same catharsis that I had the very first time that I successfully made bread in my home when I was like living out in Long Island, out in Setauket, or when I was living in a garage in Williamsburg and baking, baking out of my home oven for street markets.
Let's talk about your book, My Pizza, The Easy No-Knead Way to Make Spectacular Pizza at Home. Now, you had the no-knead method of bread, which you invented, and you've gone on from your bakery to own company, which is a pizza restaurant. No-knead pizza dough? We really don't need to knead our pizza dough?
Would you consider pizza dough or dough to be even the same family of bread?
I do.
Okay. Therefore,
aha.
Why do we think that way?
I don't know. Jim Leahy has taught us that we've thought wrong because evidently we don't.
I remember once upon a time the reason why bagels and bread sucks and pizza sucks in Florida is because you need New York water. Have you ever heard of anything so ludicrous?
Yeah, I remember that rumor a myth. I remember that.
Well, it became like it's a more of a, when we say things like this, it's more of a symptom of what we don't know.
Right. You didn't know, so you had to make something up to make it make sense.
Yeah, you got to have the water from New York, from Brooklyn. This is real Brooklyn water. These bagels are made with Brooklyn water here. So, we import our water to make our bagels and our pizza, yeah.
Jim, I just want to interrupt you to say, I like having you on the show because it's a whole cast of characters we get on the other side over there. That's great. You were two different guys there. That was great.
I'm like, 20.
Oh, really? You should see someone about that. But
I know.
But no, so the no-knead pizza, your pizzas look fantastic. And what's really exciting about this is I think most people have an idea that pizza, really, you need a specialized oven. You need a Mario Batali oven with the fire in there, and it takes all day.
Mario just wants to sell more goods, and I get it, man. By the way,
they're also pretty cool ovens. But yeah. What's cool about your book is you teach people how to make, and I don't think people are going to believe it until they actually try it, make pizza on a stone in their oven at home. Really possible to be great that way?
And you can make pizza at home that is better than anything you could buy at your local pizza joint, pizzeria, artisanal, so-called artisanal Neapolitan Caputo 000 BS.
All right, I just want to put out there that this is coming from Jim Leahy, who basically invented the no-knead bread baking, which revolutionized bread baking around the world. You know, first written about by Mark Bittman.
Yes, I just want to say one thing. You know, my bread is being translated into Italian.
Really?
Yes.
That's awesome.
A huge honor to jump the pond.
My Bread is the first book, and for an American book on bread be translated into Italian is quite that's quite a feat.
I know. I'm looking forward to the Italian book tour.
That sounds great. All right, so but my pizza let's
at home you can make using my method, you can make spectacular pizza at home, and the book is really trying to open up the language for what can go on a dough. If the dough itself, when you open it, is the canvas, and there are a myriad of possibilities, some requiring that are vegan. I tried to do a whole group of pizzas that are, you know, vegan friendly. Unfortunately, we don't have a gluten free pizza, but who knows?
It's called a bowl of vegetables.
Yeah, exactly. There's a solution.
There you go.
Vegetables. That's
you
need a gluten-free diet.
So let's debunk some of the myths that most people have or some of the preconceptions that most people have about pizza. I need an oven that gets up to 1,000 degrees to cook pizza.
Myth.
Okay. Tell us how.
Well, newer ovens often have, like, shut-off temperature limits, and sometimes electrical ovens, again, have, like, a thermal control called a high-limit switch.
Mm-hmm.
Which will turn the oven off if the internal, even the broiler goes over 600.
Right.
You can bypass that sometimes by keeping the door open ajar. And in some cases, with older ovens that like have broilers in the top of the oven, not the bottom.
Right.
Or new ovens that have broilers in the top. Like I have a Gen Air that's not like too fancy, but it's heavy duty.
Mm-hmm.
So that broiler stays on. The pizza stone that I use, which I keep at about 4 inches from the broiler itself, at like the top rack, or just below the top rack, gets to anywhere between 580 to 640 degrees. I find the pizza comes out better the hotter it gets.
Right.
So ideally, you know, if you have one of those fancy little food lasers, you want to see the stone read 600 or greater.
Uh-huh.
That you get a real good finish on the bottom crust,
mm-hmm.
and you don't have to mess with it or move it around too much.
So 600 degrees, getting the stone to 600 degrees is sufficient to make great pizza.
Absolutely.
And in your book, you discuss how to do that with conventional gas ovens, modern and older, and also even with electric ovens that have shut-off switches, how you can get the stone up there to make
great
pizza.
You really do have to, again, being that in the home,
mm-hmm.
not all cooking conditions are identical,
right?
And it's preposterous when we write cookbooks,
right,
that we presume that everyone has the same equipment,
right?
So you know, when we send our recipes out to people to test, typically the recipe tester has a different oven,
sure.
And they have to kind of make your recipe work with their equipment because they're dealing with what other people have,
right?
You know?
And your home oven might be 15 to 25 degrees different than what that little dial at the top says. I mean,
that is true too.
Yeah,
you know? True too. That's why it's
I just want to recommend to our listeners that having that instant read thermometer is very important, and or even just a hanging thermometer in there is great. I mean, I cooked Thanksgiving dinner on an oven that I was like, that turkey's never going to get brown. It's never going to get brown because, just the oven wasn't getting up to what the
didn't have enough guts.
Well, there's also the inertia factor as well.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, the thicker the stone, obviously the better. I mean, some ceramic is better than cement because there are some pizza stones that are out there that are made from cement, refractory cement, concrete. But ceramic, like kiln tile or things that are like an inch or thicker,
right,
are going to retain more heat and suffer from inertia less and actually push back more, if you will, because of the heat retention.
Right.
And also the radiation, the infrared radiation that they emit.
Right.
Because ceramic, shines invisible radiation, invisible light.
And you recommend an inch and a half pizza stone if you can find it, whereas most of the stuff that's out there is less.
I don't think you can find an inch. You can find kiln tile.
Right.
You can find a kiln tile, I think, is if you go online and you look for a kiln tile, you could even you might even be able to find a piece that's that will fit your oven in a unique way.
All right, so I have kiln tile, and then I also need to get that special spatula that we make the pizza on and transfer to the stone.
Yeah, the pizza peel. Or you can do what I did. I did on, if you go to Martha Stewart's website, about 3 years ago when I opened up Company Restaurant, I didn't include this in the book because I didn't think, this is just something I could, I thought it was already out there, so there's no need to. But you can actually just take the dough, open it up with your hands, pull your oven rack out if it's sturdy enough, and if you're, or if you have oven mitts and you're not afraid of picking up something at 600 degrees, although the reason I don't recommend this is because it's dangerous, you can actually take the dough, put it straight on the stone, dress the pizza, then put the stone that's insanely freaking hot back in the oven to finish. And that works too, in which case you don't need a peel.
Yeah, I'm going for the peel, brother.
I would go for the peel.
I'm going for the peel.
I would caution anyone when working this way to always be to use and exercise common sense and caution.
Yeah, closed-toed shoes, for example.
Closed-toed shoes in case that cheese should run off, or don't go to the other room and sit down and watch the rest of the game.
Yeah.
While the pizza's in the oven, otherwise you might be calling the fire department.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right. So
it does contain oil.
So I've got the peel. I've got great ingredients. Let's talk. The other thing that I think intimidates a lot of people about pizza at home is, I watch guys tossing pizza dough, and I can't do that. I mean, but you really simplify the dough, and you simplify how to stretch it. And
well, I think that you have to stop looking at the dough as the enemy and realize that less is more.
Love the dough, brother. Love the dough.
Love the dough. Well, all you want to do is open the dough. You don't want to plotsky the dough. You don't want to finger the dough. You don't want to molest or
You just used the word plotsky that I have never heard before.
Plotsky is a Yiddish word to futz with.
Okay. Oh, see, I got that. I like
plotsky.
That
you don't want to plotsky the dough. You don't want to mess with it. You don't want to beat it up. I mean, if you do, it has nothing to do. It's incidental to your desire to eat a pizza. That's just your issue, your baggage, and that might have a lot to do with your early childhood and the way your parents raised you. And
got it.
Don't touch that.
Got it.
We all have within us, and for whatever weird reason, I don't think it's a bad thing. When you introduce an adult who's typically doesn't touch wet, gooey, sticky things unless they have a child and they have to, clean diapers or whatever, typically, we don't touch dough unless we're chefs, and most of the dough and our notion of pizza that's out there is this really bad, industrialized, hopeless, sad,
You could say
the pizza that lacks self-esteem.
You mentioned
generic pizza. The pizza mafia is probably planning a hit on me now.
You mentioned early in your book a woman who came into your company and said, "This pizza's all wrong," and she went on to list all the ways that your pizza is different from commercial.
You didn't
crappy
use
pizza.
That frozen dough that you can.
Well,
it's
again,
not floppy.
Again, when we opened up company. I like to say, because I don't have a last name that ends in a vowel.
Right.
Because I don't even look Italian. I look more, I don't know what I look. I have no quote unquote, genetic legitimacy.
No genetic bona fides.
How dare you? How dare you make pizza? I'm joking.
Yeah.
But it kind of seemed that way. You know, how dare you not make the same pizza that I grew up with,
right,
you know, in a suburban shopping mall in Maryland. How
right.
dare you?
Right. You don't know what pizza is.
You don't know what pizza is. There's not enough fucking cheese on this. There's not enough, there's not enough sauce. And again, I don't want to make that pizza.
Right, right.
That pizza makes people ill.
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is, look, the world, even if you like that pizza, the world doesn't need one more place making it.
Right, exactly.
You know?
Yeah. So, and actually, we need to be cooking more things at home anyway.
I'm with you. And I tell you, one of the reasons that we wanted to have you on the show was, I think that while bread is somewhat intimidating, people are sort of looking to get it, but pizza is very intimidating to most people at home. And your pizza book, I think, really makes it accessible, and it also makes me want to come to the company. So,
well, I you know, I thank you. I mean, the end of the day, this book is not an elaborate technical treatise.
Uh-huh.
It's just a way to disarm the viewer so that they can approach it.
You know what it is? It's a way to make great freaking pizza at home, and if you didn't think you could, you can. The book is I'm going to plug you here. The book is My Pizza, The Easy, No-Need Way to Make Spectacular Pizza at Home by Jim Leahy, who is founder of Sullivan Street Bakery and Company in New York City. But the book is phenomenal, and you can find out more about it on our website at restaurantguysradio.com.
Mark and Francis, thank you so much for having me on your show.
It was terrific to have you.
And I invite you to come into the bakery whenever you want.
Damn Skippy.
To get a tour.
Damn Skippy. You know, I've never been to your – I was at the Sullivan Street Bakery when you first opened up, and then since you moved to your larger digs, I haven't been down there, though I've continued to eat your bread. And you know what? We're going to come see you.
Yeah, definitely come by. We'll either bake or break some bread together.
Maybe we'll do a little bit of both. Hey, listen, stick with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis.
You know, Jim said something at the beginning of that show that I just don't think is true. I just don't think is right. He said, you know, bread in these fine restaurants is kind of the bastard stepchild. And I really don't think that that's true. I think that so many people, and I'm one of them, I kind of get a feel for what my experience is going to be when the bread arrives. I'm thinking... You know, is this going to be a good positive experience or a bad experience? And when the bread and whatever dip / butter they serve with it,
oil, you know, butter, dip.
If
butter.
There's foil on the butter, I'm not going to have a great time. Okay,
you know, I'll tell you though, I don't think he was referring to the fine restaurants. I think what he was saying is that in so many restaurants, the bread is an afterthought, and I think, but to your point, you know, when you go into a restaurant and you see that you get the industrial bread, mm-hmm. and you know what's funny? You know, what people don't realize is, like, why are these restaurants so expensive? You know, those are one of the things that restaurants don't charge you for bread,
right.
So it's got to fold into the entree.
Right,
and
but
look,
most of us are spending thousands of dollars a week on bread. You know,
right. Oh, well, you know, people don't realize, well, a lot of us aren't. We're spending hundreds of dollars a week, dozens of dollars a week on bread, you know what I mean? So, I mean, when you walk into a restaurant and you think, well, you know, why are the entrees here $35 instead of $25. Well, you know, a person can eat $3 worth of bread in our restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In a lot of restaurants, you could eat a loaf and it wouldn't be $3.
Right.
You know, but literally a person can eat $3 worth of bread. Never mind that you have to order more bread than you can use, and some of it gets ripped up and made into bread pudding at the end of the night, you know, which, I mean, and I don't know. It's just breads can be very expensive if you don't bake it yourself. And if you do bake it yourself, well, then you have a bakery. So all the restaurants that bake their own bread, or most of them, also sell their bread to others because you can't amortize the cost of a bread bakery.
Well, unless you're such a big restaurant.
Right.
It's very difficult to roll that into the cost of your restaurant.
So I agree with you both. I'm the ultimate diplomat here. I agree with what he said,
really?
And I agree with what you say. Yeah, it's so unusual for me. But, you know, I agree completely that you sit down and you have the bread and, you know,
that first impression of the restaurant, it's a big one.
And it shows you very few restaurants, like, take the trouble to have fantastic bread and then don't have great food.
Exactly.
I mean, there are a few restaurants that don't really care about the bread and have good food anyway, but there's I can't think of a restaurant that I went to and I was like, wow, the bread is great. Oh, and the butter is delicious. And the bread and butter is fantastic. And
then
the rest of the food is not at least
less than
good or very good. You know, I mean, I can't think of it. So, interesting. Bread is bread of life. I don't know. I was trying to come up with something.
Really?
No, you know what? I'm sorry.
Next time I want you to think
milk
before you speak.
Milk and honey bread.
Right?
I started the sentence and I didn't have an end in mind. And I had the show, didn't it? Anyway, well, I hope you've enjoyed the last hour of talking to the restaurant guys or listening to the restaurant guys. I know that we certainly have. You might have been talking to us yelling at your radio. You bastards. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the restaurant guys at restaurantguysradio.com.